Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast.
Welcome back to Right on Four Corners. I'm your host, Delcherie Gladden. I'm an author of over 30 published novels. And on this week's episode, I have Jerry D. Thompson, and he's going to be talking about his book, Under the Pinyon Tree. Jerry, go ahead and introduce yourself.
My name is Jerry Thompson. Pleasure to be with you. I teach history here at Texas A&M.
So, Jerry, tell us a little bit about your writing background. You are a historical author, but generally, what's your focus? Because this is a little different from some of your other books, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Very much so. I was very, very insecure in writing this book. I, too, have written over 30 books or edited 30 books. My specialty has tended to be on the American Civil War in the American Southwest, especially the Texas-New Mexico borderlands, but also the 1861-1862 invasion of New Mexico territory. And I had never written anything like this before. I had written a book a couple of years ago with the University of Oklahoma Press on my outlaw grandfather. I didn't know until after my mother passed away that he was half-breed Cherokee and robbed some 15 banks in Oklahoma along with five trains and eventually fled to Arizona, changed his name, got arrested by the feds, and this time spent 14 years in Leavenworth prison. So I had a little bit of family history, but I thought the coming of age in Pytown, this little small community in the what I call the high country in western New Mexico, was really unique, and so I thought I'd sit down and write this. And I was very fortunate that the University of New Mexico published the book, because university presses usually do not publish memoirs.
UNM Press has been open to a pretty diverse range. So tell me, starting this out, because like you said, there is some personal history involved with the writing of this. Tell the readers the premise and your connection to it.
Well, I just couldn't stop writing history, so I put in a couple of chapters on the history of what is today Catron County. Catron County is the largest county in the state, as you may know, with the one of the smallest populations. I think there's a county in the east that has less, but Catron County has so few people per square mile because a large part of the county is either national forest or the vast Gila wilderness. But my family came there to the Pytown area in the 1930s, like so many other people that were busted in the Dust Bowl. My grandfather was running a furniture store in Odessa, Texas, and of course, when the Depression hit in 1929, nobody could buy furniture anymore. So he told me that he had the option of either buying a car, because he said he had saved some money and not lost it all, or buying a chicken farm outside of Odessa. And he thought about this and thought about it and decided, well, he would buy an old used car and take off for California and wound up out in the mountains of New Mexico. This was kind of the last frontier around the turn of the century. It was one of the last areas of the state to really be settled and quote-unquote civilized. And coming of age there, I had known quite a bit about the history, but I did a lot of additional research and tried to kind of set the stage for my going to Big Pytown Elementary School.
You really painted such an interesting picture in the early chapters of this area being colonized. It's always funny because my kids are both, I have a senior and one who's in college now, and both when they were going through high school, you know, had to take New Mexico history, and they both complained so much about how boring it was. But we have such a fascinating history in this state. What I really enjoyed about the early chapters in this one is that you take the interesting mixture of people who have ended up in New Mexico over its history and those interactions with the indigenous people and cultures in the Spanish that have come in. And in this book, you get to see that on a very small scale. And that was something that I really enjoy learning about the history of New Mexico. But I really hadn't gotten that look down on such a personal level. That was neat to see the early communities that were started from some of the people coming here to try ranching and farming. And then you talked about the influx of people from Texas and the tensions that that caused. And so I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that, you know, in that time period where it sounds like your family was coming in as well, just that mixture of history and everything that had already gone on between the various groups who were inhabiting the area of New Mexico and what that looked like.
Well, I'm not sure that Texas influx was always a very positive thing. Following the fall of the Alamo in 1836, there was some really deep-rooted racism that took place here in Texas that even persisted into the modern era. And I think that spilled over into western New Mexico when they began to see a large influx of people from Texas that are either working on ranches or buying ranches or settling there. And this clashed with the Hispanic community that was already there, that had established little small communities along the headwaters of the San Francisco and the Tularosa River, and eventually established this little place called Rito Quemado, just about 5 or 6 miles east of modern-day Quemado. And so there was a great deal of ethnic tension there that kind of, I guess, reached its climax in the famous El Fuego Baca gun battle at Upper Frisco. I didn't want to dwell on that in the book because that has been written about dozens of times. But I did want to get into that early history as much as possible when the Hispanos from the Rio Grande Valley began to kind of, you know, raid into that area. And that's an interesting area because it's where kind of the Chiricahua Apache from the south and the desert lowlands kind of abut against the Dine, the Navajo Nation in the plateaus to the north. And I think during the Civil War, which is kind of what I know the most about, if you look at the documentation, these people from the central Rio Grande Valley began to scout into that area, good or bad, fighting with the Navajo or taking slaves or doing all kinds of things. And they spotted these little creeks and these water holes and grasslands and just vast, vast forests, and said, well, you know, this is a great place to settle. So they began to settle in that area and also eastern Arizona in the upper headwaters of the Little Colorado. And that's kind of the beginning of that Hispano history of the area there that ran into this influx of Texans in the period after the Civil War. They carried a lot of this racial cultural baggage with them, I think.
That's interesting to know more about where that came from and then see how that's changed and developed over time in various ways. Being such a diverse area, I think there's, with such a long history too, there's bound to be racial tensions. I think we're still working in this area of providing better understanding of the state's history and the various peoples who have been here. And that's not an easy task.
I think the more history we know, the more tolerant we become. I know when I went to high school there in this little place called Quemado, we had no sense of any racial tension whatsoever, but it certainly did exist there at one time. And I thought a few years ago that I would go and see a high school basketball game because I'd played basketball in high school. There's not much you have to do out there in the winter. And I was astounded that about one-third of the mighty Quemado High School Eagles were Navajo. And I don't think I saw a single Navajo student when I was going to high school there. Now, of course, we competed against Navajo schools from the north and Gallup and Rehoboth and St. Michael's and Shiprock and elsewhere.
Well, that's interesting to see how things change, because that area, like you said, is still fairly sparsely populated. The towns haven't become big metropolises or anything like that. It's still a small rural area, but it's changed. And you talk about that throughout the story of, you know, this glimpse of the very beginnings of that area in Catron County and your experience growing up in that area and seeing how it changed over time. And I wanted to ask you, have you been back? Did you go back to do some of the research and see where things are at, or do you get chances to visit?
Yes. Yes, in fact, I try to spend the summers out there. I have a little small ranch up in the mountains up there at about 8,000 feet. That's very pleasant in the summer, so I try to escape the terrible South Texas heat that we have here in South Texas. So I still spend quite a bit of time out there and sometimes go there at Christmas. So I know the area, having been born and raised there, but I spend quite a bit of time there, either in the state archives in Santa Fe or looking at records in Silver City, or at that time, Catron was part of Socorro County until 1921. So a lot of the Catron County records are in Socorro. And of course, a lot of the Catron County records are in Reserve, which is the small county seat there.
So that brings me to another question that I'll get to in a minute. But having looked at so much of the history and how this area was built, and then having personally experienced that over your lifetime, what would you say, for being a small rural area that had its start as farming and ranching and the community that is today, what do you think are one of the things that you've seen change over time that maybe is unexpected or that you find interesting about that just progression?
Well, I don't want to get too deep into politics for revealing my political inclinations, but it's very interesting that that particular county is a very, very red county. I remember, I think Al Gore got 120 votes and George Bush got something like 1,300 in the election when they first competed. But it's a very red county that's surprisingly generally surrounded by counties that are very blue, even including Apache County in Arizona. And, of course, Grant County to the south, Sierra County to the south, Socorro County to the east. And then, of course, we have that new county, new to me, Cibola County in the north. And then, of course, it partly borders a little bit of, did at one time, part of McKinley County, which is Gallup. So the politics there have really, really changed. And when I go back out there, it's astounding to me how much I would call it just anti-environmentalism exists in both of the larger communities in the county, both in Reserve and in Kamado. But I've also seen this in the little small county of Dattle, or not Teal, I guess it should be, but we all call it Dattle, just like we always say, Mogollon instead of Mogollon, which is really the correct Spanish, I think. But it's interesting that so many people in that county of Catron are dependent upon the federal government for their welfare, either ranchers who graze their cattle in these large expanses of the national forest for a pittance, or people who work for the Forest Service or work directly for the federal government. Yet I've never seen a county in New Mexico that is so much anti-Santa Fe, much less anti-Washington, D.C. It's a very interesting place politically. And as you say, it's very, very rural. There's only two little small communities, Reserve and Kamado. Of course, you have smaller communities like Luna in Glenwood, and then Pietown, which is just, you know, almost drifted into nothing today. Very few of the people who live in Pietown today have any connection to the people who lived there when I was there. And of course, Dattle and little small ranching, but very, very small communities.
And it's interesting that New Mexico just has these pockets, and maybe it's because we are so sparsely populated through most of the state that you get that isolation and things, I don't know, seem to develop where they don't seem to have as much influence from the wider state or world.
Yes, that's a very good point. I think nobody pays them much attention because there's not many people who vote there. I mean, that entire county has less than 3,000 people today, I think. I mean, you've got that many in a small area in Rio Rancho or something. It's very, very rural. It's kind of hard for people living in Las Cruces or Roswell or Santa Fe or Albuquerque or something who have not been there to realize how really rural this is. But in many ways, it's a very beautiful, beautiful land. It's got these wide open spaces, and there's something about being able to stand on a mountaintop there and look in, you know, 100 miles in every direction and not see any man-made objects except maybe a distant lookout tower or something. There's something magic about the place. And I find the delightful time to be August when the monsoon rains come or when the aspen trees begin to turn yellow. It's just a magic time there. Now, the winters in that high country can really be bitter. And I tried to recall this as much as I could in the book that I wrote about, you know, riding a school bus for 60 miles a day, if you count both ways. And I can never remember a school day being canceled or I can remember getting stuck in the mud or getting stuck in the snow or walking for miles, but I can never remember a school day being canceled in that unbelievably bitter winter weather.
You learn how to adapt and get through it, and it sounds like this area has a lot of very hardy people who can push through and get things done.
Yes, a lot of the people who are coming into that area today, surprisingly, are people from California, I think. You know, instead of going west, as my family did, these people are going east.
Looking for those, I think, escaping some of the big city, big prices as well. Finding somewhere enjoyable that's a little bit more affordable.
Yes, I think with less taxes.
Yes. A lot of factors that go into that. You know, hopefully you can keep the rural qualities there and still enjoy the peace and quiet, even with maybe new arrivals here and there.
Yes, I think you're right.
Well, the other thing that I wanted to ask you about, you started to go into your research for this. You've got two parts, really. You've got the family side of it and your personal experiences and history, but you have a lot of just, you know, history, what people think of it, a lot of details of the development of the area, moving of the county seats and the different county rearranging throughout of it. So how do you approach that, and where do you find some of those resources?
Well, I just generally sit down and start writing and then worry about editing and revising and rewriting later. So I, you know, as I said, I just couldn't resist putting all that history in there. I guess I could have begun with just, you know, the family history when the family arrived there in 1932 and how I came of age and went to this little elementary school that just no longer exists called Pie Town. I recently saw an article of the strangest names in each of the 50 states. And of course, as you might expect, under New Mexico was the name Pie Town, sitting atop the Continental Divide there. But I tried to do as much history as I could and tried to write this objectively as I could. And I think I did a fairly decent job of it, although I think there's a lot more history that needs to be written. With the help of a local woman by the name of Helen Kress, who preserved her mother's writings, I recently put together a book for the University of North Texas Press that's going to be out, I think, next year, early in the spring, on an outlaw that operated in that Quemado area there in the 1920s. And I found that research to really be fascinating. I tried to go through every New Mexico newspaper I could find and look at as many county records as I could. And I really, really enjoyed the research as much as the writing. His name was Henry Coleman, and he was really a quite charismatic, spectacular character who supposedly would stand in front of the Justice of the Peace Office in Quemado and have somebody throw a can in the air and whip out his pistol and put two holes through the can before it could drop to the ground, but turned out to be a suspected murderer and certainly a rustler, and wound up being killed by a sheriff's posse there about 30 miles northwest of Quemado.
Wow. Yeah, he sounds like quite the fascinating character to learn a little bit more about. I hope let me know when it comes out.
The original research and writing was done by this woman who lived there in the 1950s. She was really a ranch woman, a very interesting person in herself, Eleanor Williams. And this was published in a little New Mexico electrical magazine. And so with the help of her daughter, we put this together. And then I wrote an introduction and then tried to edit it to the best of my ability. But yes, I'm looking forward to that. Murder on the Largo. We always have to have that violence in the title.
It's attention getting. But yeah, that'd be great to have you back to talk a little bit more about that when it comes out next year. So I'll keep in contact on that one. It's kind of funny that it lined up this way. My last interview that I just did was from a local author here in this area who has written several books for the Historical Society. And I was talking with her about how people can help that effort of preserving history of their families and the area. And it sounds like that's something that has helped you in your research on the personal side, but as well as, you know, other people keeping a lot of those documents and personal histories and diaries and even just some of those documents that some people may look at and be like, well, this is just, you know, everyday paperwork. We don't need to hold on to that. But there really seems to be a lot of value in even things that just seem like, you know, paperwork, and really helps tell the story of an area in kind of an unexpected way.
Yes, I think you're exactly right. I recently made friends with a, an individual in Silver City that was more than helpful. And I kept looking and looking for a photograph of this far lookout on this place called Mangus Mountain, where I worked when I was first getting out of high school. And my father and grandfather always told me about the old wooden tower that existed on the top of this mountain, because I knew that it existed because the juniper posts were still there in the ground. Of course, I, you know, was in a metal tower. But I told this to a person who was supposedly an expert on far lookouts in the Southwest, and he said, "Oh, no, that's not true." Well, I know it was true, but I kept looking and looking. And this man from Silver City was looking around and found a box of photographs in the basement of a Forest Service Ranger station that was in the process of being disposed of. And these had photographs that actually went back into the 1920s that just wound up in a box there in a Forest Service station in western New Mexico.
Oh, wow. And someone took the time to figure out what to do with them afterward. What an interesting part of history to stumble upon.
Well, yes, he thankfully he was able to preserve these.
Wonderful. Well, I hope if people come across family documents or just, you know, things like that, that they'll reach out to a local historical society or, you know, groups in their area. Because that's something that I've found really interesting over. I've had a couple of historical ones lately. Just how much you can learn about a place and how people lived by looking at seemingly unimportant documents.
Well, the little historical society there, the Catron County Historical Society in Kimano, they have a little museum there and are doing their best to preserve as many records as they can. But many of these little small museums and archives, they just don't have the financial means to sustain themselves. It's really an uphill battle.
It is, yeah. They mentioned that and the one for here. Like, we love volunteers and donations and... So yeah, if that's something that, you know, listeners are interested in history and they want to help that effort, I'm sure there is probably a historical society near you where you can pitch in some way and help that. It's really neat to know a little bit more about where we come from in an area and how we got to the point of wherever we are. I think especially just, you find a lot of surprising things, I think, especially here in the West, where people had to be very resourceful and a lot of the traditional roles or expectations kind of went out the window because you had to survive. And so if it's a woman doing it, so be it. Or, you know, you take this unusual path and that's how things worked out.
Yes, I encourage all of my students, if they have the means, to do a DNA test. And I told my wife, I said, "You need to do a DNA test." "Well, I know my grandmother said that we were Spanish, that we all came, you know, the family came from Spain." I says, "Well, that's kind of highly unlikely in the American Southwest. I know there are a lot of direct descendants of Juan de Oñate and his colonists." So I finally persuaded her to take this DNA test, and it came back 29% indigenous America.
You can find out some very interesting facts about your personal history by doing one of those. I'd had some stories passed down in my family of where we came from, and I did one of those. I was like, that is not at all true.
Well, I didn't know that my mother... I knew that my mother had this Oklahoma Native American connection, but I thought it was Osage because I knew that she had come of age in Fairfax during the midst of all the terrible Osage murders there. But when she passed away, I got to looking in a dresser in a shoebox she had, and there were some 20-plus letters that gave me the clues to this grandfather that I never knew even existed, that turned out to be this somehow well-to-do Oklahoma rancher that couldn't stop robbing banks and trains and got himself in deep, deep trouble. But yeah, we need to keep those records. And thankfully, I would never have known about him had she not bothered to preserve those few personal letters that she had that she saved and put in a shoebox. And that led to a 300-page book.
Well, I'm really glad she held on to those because that sounds like a fascinating story.
Yes, I do need to give those, I guess, to the archives probably in Oklahoma City or somewhere where they would be most pertinent.
Oh, that is a good idea. Well, we're already getting short on time. I feel like that went really fast. But I just wanted to ask you, you know, for people who pick this up and take a look at it, what's something that you hope that they take away from it and learn from your experience and the history of this area?
Well, I think there's a lot of drama in there, but at the same time, there's a lot of humor in there. There's a lot of really funny things that happened there. And I had a big quarrel with the University of New Mexico Press about the subtitle. I wanted it, you know, Coming of Age in Pytown. They said, no, no, that's too common a title. And I thought, well, how about Childhood Reminiscences or something like that? But they wound up using this subtitle of Finding a Place in Pytown, which I argued was like, you know, looking to rent a room or something. But I hope that people will enjoy the drama, but also the humor and the storyline that exists there, that, you know, this may have been difficult, but you can survive and you can persevere.
I think that's a wonderful message to share. You know, the challenges may be different today that a lot of young people face. I teach ninth grade English, and I see a lot of what these kids are dealing with. And, you know, it's very different, but still very challenging.
Well, anybody that teaches ninth grade English deserves a medal.
It's been an adventure. This is my first year doing ninth grade, and I am learning all kinds of things. But yeah, these kids, they have a lot going on in their lives. And I think the more messages of, hey, yes, it's hard. It's not always pleasant, but you can get through it. You know, it may not be forging your way through the wilderness in today's day and age, but I think that's still a really great message to pass on to people. And, you know, hang in there. You're going to get through it. There's going to be a way through either way.
Yeah, my grandfather always had that saying. What was it? I cried because I had no shoes, and then I met a man who had no feet. So mm-hmm. It doesn't matter how bad off we are, there's always somebody that's worse.
Yeah, just keep going. Keep trying, and you'll find the people along the way who will help you get there, hopefully, and persevere, like you said. I think that's something we all need on occasion, to just have that reminder. But I just want to ask you, where can people find you online, find the book, and just stay up to date on what you're doing? Because it sounds like you have some really interesting projects coming up.
There is a Wikipedia page that somebody did, which I think is fairly objectively done. If they want this book, it's available on Amazon or lots of bookstores anywhere, or can be ordered directly from the University of New Mexico Press. It's just called Under the Pinyon Tree. I thought that was very appropriate because my grandmother and I used to try to pick pinyons in the fall as much as we could.
That is. I really enjoyed the title. And I have to say, the cover art is beautiful as well.
Yes, it is. That's a 1940 Russell Lee photograph. I've got almost an entire chapter in the book just on him. He was certainly one of the New Deal 1930s best photographers, I think, and took almost 1,000 images of Pytown and the little area. He was so impressed with these new dealers that tried to persevere there. And what's interesting about his photographs is he got directions from Washington to quit showing the horrors of the Great Depression and all the poverty and starvation that was existing, but to show the positive things of FDR's New Deal. And in this, you see these people down on their luck in 1932 that are doing much, much better in 1940 with plenty of food and having rodeos and fairs and meeting at the local Farm Bureau and doing all kinds of good things.
Well, I'm glad he was able to capture some of the more positive sides of it. I think that's a probably a hard situation, a hard task that they asked him to do.
Well, those people that survived the Great Depression had come a long way. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, the war in itself really changed that area because people got jobs in El Paso and Albuquerque and Phoenix and Los Angeles. And many of those people moved away and those little homesteads became vacant.
But just another added layer to the history of this area. Thank you for taking the time, Jerry, to chat with me today. Yeah, that went by really fast. I had a lot more things on my list to talk to you about. But
Well, it was my pleasure. It was indeed a pleasure to chat with you.
Well, thank you. And just to remind our readers, the book is called Under the Pinyon Tree, Finding a Place in Pytown by Jerry D. Thompson. And that's out through UNM Press, and you can find it just about everywhere. And I hope people who are interested in New Mexico history and just what it's like to grow up in this area will take some time to check it out and just learn a little more about the state. Thank you again, Jerry, for taking the time to be on the show today.
My pleasure.
We'll be right back.
Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.